This videotape is edited from an advanced NLP training in Boulder, Colorado, April 1989. Many of the participants had also attended previous advanced training with Richard. Richard considers this seminar to be his best ever presentation of how he works with clients. Although he presents some new submodality methods, his major emphasis is on how he puts things together and the methods that he uses to create lasting change. Since this is a carefully sequenced seminar, we recommend viewing the videotapes in order.
And you have to understand that with the generalizations that people build, that one of the things that you can count on is that through their life, there are many external cues. And, you know, in terms of the wealth of external data, that they're in essence grids that are formed, that there are things that are more discrete than others. In the old research psychology stuff, they used to study different things, like they used to torture animals. They used to do things like they train an animal to respond that if something was a circle and it pressed a button, it would get a banana. And the other thing would be a C, and if they pressed it, it would get shocked. Right? And then what they do is they take the circle and they begin to open it up. So it became close to a C, and take the C and close it to a circle, thus confusing the animal immensely, because at a certain point in time, they become the same. And up to a certain point in time, the animal could handle it, and then it would go into a confusion state. Well, the same thing is true, that with external expressions, things with voice tones, with certain things and behaviors of other people, many of us have learned to calibrate. And the thing is that people build grids. Now, they also build, as time goes on, differences, because they build generalizations. There's internal responses, which are automated. There are chains of internal responses that get fired from some of these external cues. Now, the cues may or may not have anything to do with what's going on, but these things also interact in terms of a functional and what appears to be, as best as I can tell, a set of interface patterns, because they don't always work the same. Our internal state a lot of times serves as what they call in holography a reference beam. And see, when you make a hologram, a laser hologram, what happens is that you take and you put an object, okay, behind a film plate. And you take a beam and you split it in half and you shine the beam on the object and you shine the other beam onto the plate. And what happens is the light that's shining off the object goes onto the plate, plus the beam itself goes directly onto the plate. And just before it hits the plate, the light collides and it creates what's called a dispersion pattern. Now, when you take the object away, right, and you hold up the plate, you don't see anything once the plate's developed. But if you put the reference beam right back where it was, then the object looks as real as an external object. I mean, you know, you have to stick your finger through it to know it's not there. And, I mean, you know, when you make a good one in a lab. The thing about that is that the reference beam is the way of getting the object back in your mind. Because when you look at a hologram, you don't see the object the way when you look at a picture. A picture like that one over there, when you look at it, you see what's there. With a hologram, What it is that the reference beam and the dispersion pattern, the Fourier pattern you look through, tells your brain what must have been there when it was made. And if you take the hologram and you crack it in half, put the same reference beam, you see the same whole object. You don't see half the object. Now, in essence, for us, there the interaction of sound and light and feelings and temperature interacts as a reference beam that accesses internal things. But instead of it being one reference beam, it also is juxtaposed with our internal state, because our feelings also constitute part of that. That's why sometimes things trigger off and sometimes they don't. Now, for me, when I'm dealing with change, one of the things that I'm also dealing with is building an essence in people, something that's a profound enough altered state that whatever altered state they automatically go into that gets in their way, like a phobia, I want to build a state that intercepts it or precedes it, because I want the same cues to trigger off something before the fear. Because it's not that they forget that they were afraid of elevators. I don't think human beings are a read-write system. All of their past experiences or fear are there, but they don't get to it. because what they get to is the altered state that you induce when you do something like the phobia cure. That what happens is that the techniques or the tricks that you use, like running the memory backwards, the disassociation, all of that stuff is the state that they'd go into. Now, if you're really good, you even stick in front of that state something else, because I have a tendency, rather than to just leave it at that, to create what will happen when they go in, so that those cues actually build something else that precedes it. And it's not that it's impossible to get the person back to being afraid. And the more you layer things in front of whatever a difficulty or an automated response is, the more depth you create, the more lasting the effect will be. Because anybody who is capable of creating fear of elevators or this or that is capable of doing it again. Plus, they have a wealth of experience. I was talking last night about this thing with subliminal tapes. Any of you who are up at night now have seen that the cure-all of the universe is subliminal tapes. And I was listening to this, the guru of this stuff. And the theory is that it's the number of positive suggestions that induces change. I tested this and found out that it doesn't work. We made a tape that had for a friend of mine has a stress class that meets once a month. It's a good name for it anyway, if you think. It's not even a relaxation class, it's a stress class. But we made a subliminal tape for the class in which we laced, everything will freak you out. Well, I figured it was a stress class. It's the thing to do. Underneath the sound of the ocean, the thousands and thousands of suggestions that everything will make you nervous, you'll be uptight, your blood pressure will rise at every moment. And gave people the tape and told them it was a relaxation tape and to listen to it, as much as they could, all day long, play it in the car, everywhere they were. They all came back, and not some of them, they all came back and said it was the best, most relaxing month of their life. Which means that perhaps we had a group of people that had a polarity response at the unconscious level. But I don't think so. Because, see, it's not the number of suggestions, it's the way in which suggestions are made. Because it's not the amount of times you've been afraid, it's what you access and in what order you access your own experience. See, that the trick is given the variety of ways that people have to access the way in which they're going to respond at a moment, you need to be able to lace and to layer down the kinds of responses that they're going to have. It's not enough to wipe something out. You have to put things in its place. And the more depth you put, see, for me, that by building a chain of responses that will happen kinesthetically, to build in automated responses, to build in layers of generalization, and to build in propelled systems. For me, propulsion systems are one of the interesting things about human beings, that the kind of effort that guy put into the activity of dealing with what he was afraid of, and that the way that the thought that went into it, and that if by taking that amount of energy, that powerful of a propulsion system, and getting it to aim towards making his life better, towards as I put it to him, making up for lost time, so that 30 years from now when he looked at his life, he will have filled it up with good stuff, see, there's a theory for a long time that if you experienced, fear fully, that it would go away. It's the old confront your fear thing, that if you just confront it and feel it deeply, that somehow or other it will go away. Well, people like him are a good example of the fact that if you stuck him in fearful situations, it wouldn't help, because it wasn't the fearful situation that was creating it. It wasn't a group of people that made him afraid. It was what he was doing, that his ability to become immobilized when he tried to walk up at the bar was based on what he did when he walked in, looked and saw a group of people, realized he had to go and talk with other people there. It actually, because I asked him, I said, how long did it take? And he said, well, it didn't take long to get afraid. And it doesn't. And he's mastered it, and he can do it quickly. Now, if I was sitting by myself, he wouldn't have bothered. But if instead, because I said, think of all the things you didn't scan that group for. And he went, what? Now, this is a good response to get from clients. Because a lot of times I'll say, just repeat what I said. because there are certain things that I delineate are not within the scope of the study. And we've tried an experiment during the practitioner course of getting people to just change the way they said things. And we found out there were some people just couldn't say it certain ways. Like we had in my group, I had a lot of real estate people. And one of them said, you know, well, that they found out, you know, that they can get people to want to buy a house, but it's too expensive. And if I said, well, is there one you can call? And the guy said, well, he said, I could call 100 of them. And I thought, well, he's exaggerating, until I found out how much real estate the guy owned, 600 pieces in San Diego alone. He don't have any trouble buying real estate. It's Robert Allen's top student. But I said, if you take one of these people, and what you do is tell them that you want them to say, the house is too expensive. I said, just have them say that to you. And so he called up this guy on the phone, and he says, okay. He said, you know that house I showed you? And the guy said, yeah. He said, I want you to tell me it's too expensive. The guy said, well, the house is too expensive, but I want it. Now, that's a change in direction. Now, and in fact, then the guy started calling him on the phone, wanting to buy the house. Because, you see, if you start in one place, then you lead to another. And it's not just a polarity flip-flop back and forth, because you can flip-flop back and forth. But when you set up a direction, it sets up what becomes a primary focus. See, whereas the guy goes, I want the house, but it's too expensive, it creates an end. Whereas if the house is too expensive, but I want it, then you start doing things about changing what your payments will be and what the cost is. One puts things inside the scope of the study. By changing the way you think about things and the way you talk about things, it changes what you're capable of doing. Now, the exercise you just did, to me, the next step in it, and which we don't have time for, so we won't do, has to do with taking that kind of an attitude and then layering more things onto it, so that you can layer onto that state things about being ferocious, that you can layer on top of that things about being more intrigued, especially building for yourself. Remember the belief stuff? You guys remember how you build a belief? Do you guys know how to build a belief? Well, you know you have beliefs, right? You guys read Using Your Brain for a Change? Try it sometime. You're not supposed to just read the words. Okay, yeah, I read the book. I know that. Okay. If you can change a belief from one to the other, as soon as you know what the submodalities of a belief are, you can build one. All you do is you take the submodalities and you decide what you want to believe and you put it in there. Now, one of the beliefs that I find to be extremely useful is the belief that people work perfectly. There's nothing wrong with them. That, you know, the way... See, that you have to start with the thing about disassociating from any of you who have what I refer to as empathy disease. Empathy disease is because, like, when I was in college, I took this psychology class, and they told me you had to be warm and empathetic and genuine in order to be helpful to people. And the one I had trouble was the empathy one, because if you put yourself in their shoes, you were stuck like them. And I mean, to me, that made sense. To my teacher, couldn't see that from my point of view, so he was stuck. So he couldn't help me to understand something I razzed him about to no end. Now, the thing is when you do switch referential index with people where you put yourself with their limitations and feel their pain, then you feel how it would be unpleasant to work a certain way. And then the fact that it feels unpleasant or that it limits you or it's frustrating or it's frightening is true, but it nonetheless is it's not something that identifying with is going to make it so that you can help them out of it. The fact is that I know how terrified this guy was I worked with. I also know I don't want to live that way. I want to have nothing to do with it. I don't want to live that way, but I knew out of the gate I didn't have to. Now, that means I'm free. And a lot of people don't build that into themselves that, you know, when a client comes in and tells me how horrible things are, my response is, God, I'm glad I don't have to live that way. And people think that's callous. Well, I think it's the only foundation from which you can help them at all. That, you know, if you go, God, boy, you know, he must be lonely, he must be this, he must be that, oh, how terrible it is. You're not talking about him, you're talking about you. And when you're talking about you in that context, since you don't even have the problem, it's utterly ludicrous. I mean, it really is. And until you can really look at it as ludicrous, you'll keep doing those things. I mean, the response is when this guy comes in, I go, God, what a pain in the ass to live that way. Sitting on the floor in your car. You know, I mean, I even look at him and I go, don't you feel foolish? And the guy goes, well, why do you think I get on the floor? You know, I go, well, that clears it right up. You know, and, you know, because when you can look at him, you can go, you know, does it strike you as stupid to live this way? And the guy goes, the guy will say to you, well, yeah, but, you know, with his fear, there's no other way to live. And then I can say to him, say to me, with this fear, there's no other way to live. Ooh. You feel that ooh? Now, that's when you get them started. Because to begin with, you've got to break it up. I don't even have to tell them what the next line is, because they'll fill it in. They're going to fill it in, and that's what they're there for. They're not there for to have anybody reinforce their difficulty, because you couldn't do it as well as them if you tried. I mean, this guy's got this down cold. Now, in order to break them out of it, you've got to be able to create that ooh phenomenon. And you've got to be looking to do it, too. You know, it's one of those things that hurts so good. It does, because it makes it so they know that they're getting up to the edge of the limits of their model. And there's two ways to bring people to the limits. One gets them to start fighting back, and the other gets them to look at that open doorway and realize they can step through it. And then that's when you got to hold them back. You got to go, yes, but not yet. Right? Because when you want them to go through, you want them to go through like they were shot out of a cannon. Right? Because they don't even know what's on the other side yet. They don't even know. When I start to bring up things, I go, like, when you walked up to this group of people, I said, you know, you were looking for how you were going to speak to me without, you know, what are you going to do? Send a note over? You know, and the guy kind of smiled, you know. So it had crossed his mind, right? You know, get a bellman to, you know, go talk to a group of different bellmen, you know, and send a note over. Because that doesn't count, because I don't notice it, right? But the thing is I said, you know, you weren't looking for the group, you know, figuring who could you go out with, you know, who could you go party with, you know, who could you, you know. And as I said these things, he went, well, of course not. And I went, well, which is stupider, not looking for that or hiding on the floor of the car? Now, that's an interesting comparison if you think about it. Because what I'm asking the guy to do is to compare two negative outcomes with each other. Either way, I win. Because again, what I'm doing is beginning to build a propulsion system by getting this guy to do what he did well, which was comparison. He was not an in-time kind of guy, if you think about it. I mean, could you maintain his difficulty if you were in time? It takes too much memory to do that. Too much planning. In-time people can't plan that well. You know, they would find themselves in a terrifying situation and go, oops, you know. Shit, I'm talking to a group of people. I forgot, you know. Ah! You know, in-time people are screamers, right? Guys like him never get to the point of screaming, you know. Hell, he'd be crocked before he got up in front of the group. You know, they'd go, he'd walk up in front of them and go, my name's so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, that'd be his first major group to talk to. The thing is that by beginning to build a web and beginning to listen to difficulties and beginning, if somebody's dealing with comparisons, to start out by building multiple negatives and multiple positives, you begin to build the foundation of what I call a complex. Because the thing is I'm going to build multiple negatives so that I can blow up the negative state by literally turning it on itself at some point. But I build it up slowly, and at the same time I build that foundation, I'm going to build a foundation of positive stuff on the other side, which is the stuff he's missing out on. And that's going to have to do with, since he's a between time kind of guy, having him jump instead of to the past, into the future. Because I want him to be more terrified of living the way he is than he is of whatever the difficulty is. And even though it's not the most positive attitude approach to things, he's not ready for a positive attitude. He's got to have a terror to avoid, and the only way to avoid it is to have a positive attitude. Now, with this guy, by the time I'd spent a three-hour session with him, he was so terrified, he went down into the bar and sat there and talked to a group of 16 people with me and was gregarious. And at one point, he left, and then he came back, and I said, "What'd you do when you were gone?" He said, "I had to go have a talk with myself." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, my fear started to come back, and it scared the hell out of me." Now, there's an interesting double bind in this, in that feeling the fear then becomes ambiguous as to whether it's a fear of the situation or whether it's a fear of if he doesn't conquer the situation, he'll miss enjoying himself. Because what I've done is to open up and close the circle. The thing I told you about, we have a zero, we have a C. The Q for him was fear. And the fear was a particular Q. Now, by doing the little game that I played with him, opening this one up and closing this one down, what happens is I confuse that in him and assign a new cue so that what the fear actually becomes is something that's ambiguous. What I'm building in when I work with somebody is an ambiguity that switches the cue so that the fear itself now became a fear of not being social, whereas before it was a fear of being social. So that the same kind of a trigger now triggers off a whole other propulsion system. So that,
So you're utilizing his away from strategy, but in doing that, you're also building it towards, because he's on another level, he's wanting to go towards what he's missing. Right?
He has to.
Right, so, you know, you're not only utilizing the away from it.
Well, you have to be careful with it. I am utilizing it. But utilization is a big word. I'm telling you how I utilize it. Okay. And one thing I want you to watch here is I don't want you to categorize things, because I find that people learn these NLP terms and they use them to not think. Right? They go, "Oh, that's utilization," and they lump it all into utilization instead of sorting utilization out. It's the way in which it was utilized that's important. The important distinction is what's different about this utilization than other utilization. And the difference falls down to that I'm taking the same internal cue. It's the same external situation, right? It creates the same internal response, fear, right? External situation, many people. Internal state, fear. Okay. Generalization, fear is of external situation. I change that to fear is of avoiding external situation.
But my point was also that in using the fear and building a fear, you're also building a want in him that's stronger than he's had before. Right?
Yes, I am. And that's because that's exactly what I want to do, is to build in desire.
Right. Yeah.
And the thing is it isn't that people are just moving away or moving towards. It's not that simple. They're doing both always at the same time. And it's a question of what they're doing with which. I mean, you know, you can say he's moving away from groups, or you can say he's moving towards, you know, safety, right? You can say he's moving away from fear, or you can say he's just moving towards loneliness. I mean, you know, you can do it as a description. The thing is to be able to take the metaprogram distinction without changing the distinction itself in him. And to be able to make it so that it creates an ambiguity in the situation that makes him propelled towards behaviors. So that, and the difference is he was moving away from the past. That's fine. I want him moving towards the future, which is what he was kind of doing anyway. That's why he was going to all the damn therapy. You know, I mean, you'll find that people are moving towards the future. They're just not good at it. And I don't mean that. I mean, it's, you know, it's fine for them. I don't want to live that way. And if they work with me, I know they don't want to live that way or they wouldn't be here. And so what I'm trying to do is to create a context. And it's, you know, it's not something that's done simply or, you know, in the sense that it's just one piece. It's being able to line up a series of pieces and punch them all at once. And then it gets down to, you know, to sometimes with instructions. I mean, with him, I gave him a list of homework a mile long. And 3 pages of things to do. And, you know, it's like, I love this. He had bought, and when he got such good results from the book, you know, he bought Using Your Brain for a Change, I think, or Frogs into Princes, I forget which. And he had, quote unquote, fixed himself so much. The next thing he did is he bought every book and every videotape. Okay. And he looked at a lot of them, but there was a couple that he didn't look at. For example, the flirting tape. He had it there, but he didn't open it. Right? And when he, one of the things he said, you know, at the end of his session is he said, "Do you think I'm ready for the flirting tape?" And I said, "I think you've been ready for it for years." I said, "But if you watch it, you have to try everything that's on it. You have to watch one thing and go try it, and then watch the next thing and try it. You can't watch the whole film." And he looked at me like that made sense. Which clients do that, which has always amazed me, but that's the way they are. And did you like the little exercise we did this morning? Okay, well, one of the things about it is that that's not enough. As you know, my policy is too much is not enough. But one of the things that I try to build in people is I try to build a broader range of response from a state. And I've discovered that some people, like, they can either be aggressive and ferocious, but they can't be exhilarated and happy while they're doing it. And that one of the things I like to be able to do is to teach people how to layer states together. That if you go through and you take a, for lack of a better term, a four-tuple, or a set of submodalities. So you take one like, you take the exhilarated state, and you call that state number one, okay? And then state number two, you take something which is, for example, if you've ever been in, found a time and a place where you were absolutely fascinated, where your attention was totally fixed, where you were learning something and you knew you were learning it, you were getting it, and your interest and your attention was just totally locked on. You know what I'm talking about? Times and places where you were so enthralled by something that you didn't want to miss even the smallest amount of it. And you did so with interest, not with opinion. Too many people I know, are when they're learning, they're thinking, and those a lot of times do not go hand in hand. That when people try to learn something by figuring out if it's like something else, I don't know if any of you teach, but I get this where I used to, I don't get it so much anymore. People used to ask me, you know, how does this fit with? And whatever they said afterwards, you know, stuff with the parent, child, and the adult? TA. People were always trying to figure out how those fit together. I looked at the NANELP catalog that came out this time, and all they're trying to do is fit stuff with NLP. You know, how does this fit with it? How do you translate this to Myers-Briggs? And how do you translate this to that? My answer is it doesn't translate without losing a lot. Just the same as when you translate any language to another language, all you do is you lose things in the process. And so if you take something which is a highly positive fixed attention, and then maybe take a state where have you ever had a day where you could do no wrong, where you were just totally on, when you were working and you always were picking the right intervention, you know, where your intuitions were working well, you just had a certain zing to it. You know what I'm talking about? Think back, remember one. You'll need it. It may not have been this morning, but you'll think back, you'll find one. You know, so you pick something that constitutes an exceptionally good day. And where it overlapped from experience to experience, you know. I don't know if any of you are gamblers in here, but I found that one of the best ways to win at gambling is to gamble at the right time. Well, I've really discovered that you can go, and no matter how well you play, if you're not in the right state, you won't win. And that the trick is to figure out when you're in the right state. When you're in the right state, you can almost play anything. Put money in slot machines and money comes pouring out. And when you play other times, the best you can do is break even or lose. So if you find something that's got that certain zing to it, where you just it has a feeling that everything is going to work, and you're just up for it. Now, if you add to that something which is, there probably have been some times where you were able to be fairly ferocious, where that, you know, one of the things I've discovered is that people try to be too nice when they do NLP, and that it doesn't work that way. It's not that you have to be mean or cruel. It's that you have to literally be in control. It's not a passive art form at all. That, you know, you can listen to clients until you're blue in the face, or you can listen to your clients until you're done listening. And at that point, you rise up like a four-toed dragon and just simply rearrange things. And sometimes when people have watched me work with clients, like, they're pulling their hair out. They couldn't understand how I let the client go on long enough. But to me, I'm stringing them rope. I'm going, here, take this rope. I want you to tie it right up here. Is it good and tight now? Does that not slip freely? Because what I'm doing for is looking for the kinds of things that allow me to take both ends of a spectrum and to change the way that they respond to experience and to make it so it's more pervasive. So it builds in me a kind of ferociousness that's connected with patience. It has a thoroughness to it, has a determination, and it's like I don't let them ramble on, I make them answer my questions. And sometimes, I don't know if you've noticed, clients, a lot of them have a story. And they won't be happy till you tell them the story. And a lot of times I interrupt the story because I make it so that until they answer my questions, I won't let them tell me the story. And when I get that message across that what their job is, and I always tell clients that they have a job, their job is to do what I say and answer my questions. And it has to do with the ability to be firm with clients. Because if you seem and project uncertainty to them, then, you see, your nonverbal communication is as important. See, to me, the importance of learning the Milton patterns themselves is so that you start out every session as a hypnotic induction. That, I mean, right out of the gate, I'm altering people's state. I'm building in everything that I say has presuppositions connected to it. That, you know, as you change yourself, when you change yourself, there's never a question of if. And that not only comes across verbally, but it comes across analogically. I make it clear on no uncertain terms that they're allowed to stay the same. You bring me a problem, it gets changed. If you decide halfway through you don't want it changed, you're still going to have to come back next time and get me to change it back. That on no uncertain terms, you hire me to do it, I'm going to do it, it's going to get done, it's going to be done my way. And because a lot of people, one of the reasons they're stuck as they are, is that they've decided what will change them. I mean, I have people come in and they go, I want you to use hypnosis to change this. And that's probably then the only thing I won't use. Because typically, if they knew what would change them, then they wouldn't be stuck the way they are to start with. And certainly, they would be the least qualified to know what techniques to use. Because it's their trying to run a session, which has probably got them in trouble in the past. And that to me, I run it like a trance, and I want it done my way and in the order that I want it. Because the order in which you do things is as important, if not more important, than actually what you do. I mean, there's lots of different ways to fix a phobia or anything else. But the most essential ingredient has to do with the way you package the whole session in terms of how it's going to affect their behavior in the future. Now, but if you take and find an experience of ferociousness, now what we're going to do is I want you to take the same kind of technique that you did before. Only instead of taking just the, you know how you place the one thing on the timeline and stood behind it, looked through it, stepped up to it, and then pushed it forward? Well, this time what I want you to do is, first we're going to do is I want you to go through and elicit these. And you don't have to go into great detail, just enough that the person would know what it's like to look through the submodalities. So that if they did the same exercise you did last time, they would be able to replace it with each one of these four. Now, I want you to really make sure that when you elicit these experiences that you get primo examples. The purpose of elicitation and the skill in it is always going to be based with your analog. You have to think of elicitation as a very short trance in congruency. That's in space congruency, okay? Not incongruency. Because when you talk about a time and a place where people were really ferocious and be able to be in control and felt powerful and like they knew what they were doing, that when you elicit that from somebody, you want all of your nonverbal, your tone of voice, your analog to help them to access prime examples of it. Now, when you find examples of each of these four, what I want you to do is then turn around just like you did before and put it out on their timeline, looking towards the future. So the future is out here. Here's the past. We're going to start from present time. And what I want you to do is first, like, take the example, which is what you did this morning, which is number one. Only I want you to put next to it number two, then after that number three, and number four, and have them literally move through time through the four. Okay. Have them spaced out at first. Okay. Then what I want you to do is have them cycle back, right, to this time, which means this is associated, then you're going to disassociate them out, bring them back through. I want you to cycle through so they can move through them rapidly. So you'll notice by watching them whether they're literally changing the facial expressions that go with each one, Now, if you want to accelerate the process, anchor each one. It will help them to go through. But make sure they move forward in time as they do it. Now, you might have this spaced on their timeline by days. I mean, this might be day one, this might be day two, this might be day three. As soon as they can move through it quickly, I want you to have them go out on their timeline, keep cycling through the same four, but pull them closer together. So that it's one, two, three, four, and then closer together until they all end up in the same place. And keep going further out into the future as you do it. Now, what this does is literally layer yourself together a new kind of a response where all of these things are operational at once. This builds you a new state. Does this make sense? Yes? Good. That's one you did this morning. Fill in the blank. See, it's also not essential that you use the same responses I'm talking about. Exercises and workshops are only examples. These are examples of how to build a better state to do NLP in. And remember, as they go out into the future, you want to either contextualize these things or not, depending upon how much you want it to ramble through people's lives. See, if you're dealing with somebody, let's say you have a client that's a total wimp, right? Comes to you, and goes and says, "So everybody pushes me around," and you go, "What?" And they go, "Nothing," that sort of a thing, where you want to build some chutzpah into it. That as you begin to take a technique like this, where you layer together three or four different types of the most ferociousness you can find in them, might be that they're only ferocious with a goldfish, or might be able to push their dog around, They might be tough with their children, but not with other adults. They might be able at work to be tough with their employees, but when it comes to women, they're a total wuss. That as you want to build it in, you want to, as you go future, contextualize, because what you're doing is taking different sets of submodalities. Submodalities, remember, is the simultaneous representation. Strategies is the sequential representation. What we're doing here is using time as a variable to literally first build a chain and then to compress that chain into a single state. Because what we're doing here is building a new and better state. Because somebody said in here when we were doing the last exercise that they could get into the state of exhilaration, but they couldn't talk when they were there. So, like with that person, we might want to throw in a number five, which is being chatty. You ever felt like you just had to talk? Sometimes you get so excited that you just have to talk. You guys know what that's about. So with that person, you want to add that dimension in. Now, you might, with your partner, ask them what kind of dimensions they feel they need more of when they're doing this kind of work. For example, you might want to make number five a sense of humor. Because doing NLP, you really have to keep your humor around you so that you don't forget and think all of this is real. It's as artificial as the rest of life. There are so many things that we believed so strongly when we were young that we don't believe anymore. I mean, I'll never forget something that happened to me. I have a friend that really grew up middle-class white bread. And he was sitting at my house, and it was Easter, and he told me this story, which I thought was the most unbelievable thing I'd ever heard. He said, "Isn't it amazing that when I was young, I believed that there was a 6-foot rabbit that went around and hid eggs?" And I looked at him, and I'd never heard of this before. If people mentioned it, I missed it somewhere along the line. And there were three other people there all laughing and nodding. And I looked at him and I said, "I beg your pardon? A 6-foot rabbit?" And they said, "Oh, yeah, He had clothes on, though, as if that made a difference, right? And they all sat there telling me that, of course, everybody knew about this when they were young, that there was this 6-foot rabbit and how amazing it was that they believed it. And I thought, how amazing it is that you're still talking about it, right? And to them that, this was artificial, but yet out of the same people, two of them thought that this was ludicrous, but yet they were Seventh-day Adventists. Now, I've had some weird things with clients. I've had some clients, and I don't know if religion and mental health seem to go hand in hand in some way, and I mean the absence of mental health, that, I had a client who literally believed that their daughter was nuts because she talked to an angel in the closet. And yet, she was speaking to Jesus every evening, at 9 o'clock when she went to bed. And to her, that wasn't abnormal. That to her, she told me when she was born again, Jesus had come to her in the middle of the night, put his arms around her, And, you know, and I love this, taken her inside of him or something like that. Whatever it is, it sounded like scary shit to me. I didn't want to know about that part of it. But to think that that sane and what her daughter was doing was something that required a psychiatrist's help, I mean, to me, it's where people have lost a little of their sense of humor. And to me, in order to put things into a perspective, it's not that Jesus didn't come to her. It's that, you know, if you're going to believe that, then it should be as possible to believe that, you know, your daughter can speak to angels in the closet. I mean, to me, those don't seem like profoundly different, right? Now, to try to explain that to her, you know, it would sound irrational. But part of what made the problem as bad as it was, because to begin with, children the same age have imaginary playmates. I mean, this was only a 7-year-old girl, right? I mean, how many of you had imaginary playmates when you were a kid, right? I love people do this stuff, you know. I'm sure more of you did. And so, how many of you had imaginary pets? You know, you had them all.
I have all.
How many of you still have them? That's what I want to know. Hey, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, it's the same thing. You know, for most of you have seen the tape of Andy the Schizophrenic. You know, it's just the thought, you know, if you can get people to come off the TV, why are you watching Little House on the Prairie? I mean, the term Playboy Channel ring a bell, you know? I mean, you know, it's those long road trips. You wouldn't be alone so much. I mean, how many shrinks would think that that was a nutty thing to do as opposed to, you know, sitting around by themselves all the time twiddling their phones? Or they could have a whole group of people there. There would be no more loneliness if people learned that strategy. You just have to have a little better taste about what programs you watch. You don't want to be watching no horror films, right? You know, Friday the 13th. Oops! Get back in there, Jason! You know, you don't want to be doing that crap. That for our purposes, we want to build the best state to make what we do as fun as possible. There are so many people that I find that, especially people who have done therapy for a long time, that they don't like doing it. They take the fun out of it. And, you know, and then, of course, the best thing to do is blame it on your clients, you know. I have boring clients. And, you know, some of them are boring, but it doesn't have to sound boring to you while it's going on. As long as you're going to see them, if you go into an exhilarated enough state where you have enough interest, where you begin to find out how this stuff works and how people can maintain it, and as long as you keep the attitude, I'm certainly glad this is me, you know, but also, by the same token, every once in a while, something comes along which you really want for yourself. And, I mean, it is a fringe benefit of this profession, being able to learn strategies, to being able to learn what's wacky and depressing in one person can be fun for you. I mean, you know, most, I don't know how many of you in here have learned, I mean, if people can see an imaginary playmate, think of the uses you could have for that. You know, just in terms of being able to try out techniques, you know, you'll never be lonely again. Uh-huh. But if one human being is capable of doing it, then the rest of us are. That, I mean, if you're somebody that never had an imaginary playmate or, you know, has never had a hallucination that looked real to you, learning how to do this is only going to expand your ability to do things, your ability to use your mind. For example, I had a friend that took his broker's examination to become a real estate person, and he claimed he couldn't remember things. But this guy had an imaginary playmates, but not one, but several. And he could dress them, play a game, and stop the game, go off and do something, and come back and start it right where they left off. And this is a guy telling me he had no memory. So I had him put all the answers to the broker's examination on their shirts, right? Freeze it and go in and take the test, right? And he got most of them right. He got a few wrong because he couldn't get the people to turn around. That's what I call a not user-friendly unconscious mind. It's a number 34. They look up and the person goes, nah, 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 nah. It's a problem with having kids as imaginary playmates too, I suppose. Now, for our purposes here, you know, if there's something you want to add to this, these are just suggestions. They're not cast in stone. You want to pick the things that you figure will make your work more dynamic. The more dynamic, the more charismatic, the more of an altered state each session is. Because remember, the event for the clients that you have, whether it's a business client, even I teach in my sales training course. I have a new sales training course I'm teaching this year, which has been a lot of fun. I went out and elicited the strategy from two compulsive buyers, people that, you know, buy things that they don't need. This one guy's got like 10,000 shirts. He just goes out 5 times a day and buys shirts, not even in his own size stuff. He has garages for him because he just had fits. His feeling he has to buy things. So I figured, there's a sales course. And so I elicited a strategy, and what you do is you install it in people and then sell them something. It's a lot easier that way. But see, even in that course, what I try to teach people is that every sales event must be high drama. That part of what makes you a good salesman or good at NLP is that you look at each event as a maximum exhilarated state. There is no such thing as nonchalant work in NLP. I mean, it's not something where you churn things out. The more profound the altered state, more exhilarating the event, and the more you connect it with people's future that way, the more generative the change is going to be and the more lasting. It should be an event that stands out the way an impact experience does. It's unforgettable, unless you give them amnesia, of course, but it should still have the same amount of power. Because the thing is if you, every session, no matter what you do, is going to be an altered state. And if it's a mundane altered state, those are the ones people have amnesia for. And when you have to remind clients that they changed last time and it was they did all right, and they squint their eyes like this, it tells you that there was not enough drama. And it's part of your job is to create that drama and that stimulation that creates the affect that makes it work, makes it last, makes it stimulating. It also makes it more fun for you in the long run, and your longevity in this business will last. Then you won't end up going, I hate going to work, you know. Instead, you should walk in and look at your clients in the waiting room and see pieces of raw meat out there. Hear the sound of a knife sharpening. Shk, shk. A lot of good auditory internal cues you can throw in while you do this. If you find when you elicited with your partner that there wasn't a lot of high-powered auditory, throw in some of that stuff. Remember, you don't have to stick with just the submodalities they had. You can use existing anchors, sounds, just like when we did the thing last time where you did the submodality shift and had the sound of the bolt slamming shut. You guys remember that? Were you here last time? And you don't remember it. It's really slammed in your mind, huh? Shut the bolt, what to do? Take all my memories and have two steel doors closed. Now, what was that we did? That being able to add naturally existing auditory anchors is always going to amplify things. Remember, we don't care what system is their primary system. That's only a way to establish a rapport. It's not the way to maintain it. You want to build people out so you're operating in every system. So you can not only anchor these things, you can add naturally existing auditory anchors that stimulate and bring things up so that you build a heightened experience. Then you stack them out one in front of the other so that they run through them in the way that builds a natural chain. In essence, it's chaining, but instead of firing one anchor, firing the other, and firing the other, you're doing it through a set of high-powered submodalities. Then what you do is you cycle through it till they can go through it fairly quickly, and then you go out further and further in the future and bring them closer and closer until they become simultaneous. And what you will end up with is a new set of submodalities for a powerful state. Okay? Grab yourself a partner, the same one if you want, or a new one, and power through this. And remember, when you do this, the timeline stuff, have them move and the timeline stand still, which means you may have to stand them up and move them around. Okay, go for it. Layering them is what it's called. You don't want to laminate them. If you laminate them, they're still separate. You know, you want to get them so that you're actually layered, so that they're all in one time. If you get them stacked, if you just get them so they're stacked real close, you don't get the full impact. See, if you think of it as lamination, all you've done is you've compressed the time so it's barely noticeable. Whereas if you get them so they compress into one thing, that's where you get the full impact. Say, actually, when I do it with people, I'll tell you that what I like to do is I like to get some anchors for things like sort of orgasmic type things to access that sort of stuff. And then you're going to handle that, huh, Robert? See, because when I do this kind of stuff with a client, typically what I like to do is I like to really build it into a gigantic crescendo. So that what I do is I access really intense types of explosive experiences. And then when I go through it, I bring them closer and closer. A lot of times I'll do this in an altered state. And I like to set up a thing where they feel a rubber band between their nose and their hand pulling, but yet they can't get their hand there, so it builds up stress. The closer their hand gets, the more they move out on their timeline, the closer they get together. And at the moment it touches, it explodes into a single unit. So that when it does it, what happens is when you set up that kind of physical tension, when you get to the point where it simply slides into a single unit as opposed to something that's laminated, you get really dramatic physiological responses. And it also integrates the kinesthetic components of the five different states. See, if you think back through time, for those of you who have done NLP for a long time, there used to be a thing called the visual squash, where you... So I can tell those of you who have been around for a long time, yeah, I remember that one, putting that part in this hand and this one in this hand, driving them together. You remember, if you remember Keith, and you get them like this, people will be like this, the last moment trying to get these two parts to fit together, and then they go, and pull them in like that. Well, the thing is that the kinesthetics of taking two, because each of the things that were in the visual squash were in themselves anchors for totally different kinesthetic states. And I mean, it's kind of like firing two really distinct anchors off at one time. You get that sort of wiped out look on their face, and their face goes asymmetrical. That was a sloppy way of going about this. But in this state, what you're doing is you're really building a much more elegant state. Now, there's another thing, which is that there's a trick embedded inside of this. The trick is that the more you project it out into the future, the fact that going into the future brings it closer together sets up a direction in the future that the more you go forward, the more you will integrate. Now, for those of you who have some hypnotic experience, you have experience with the more pattern. The more you try to resist going in trance, the more you will now. You know, and you can try in vain, but the more you try in vain to go in a trance, the more you'll begin to go into a trance now. Can you feel this happening to you? Slowly and quickly. Not too responsive, Robert. Yet. That's right. It's like the more you try to write notes, the more incoherent the page will become. The more yellow you see, the deeper trance it will be. And the more you laugh, the deeper you'll go with each breath. And they say you have to do hypnosis with a monotone. Can you believe that? Henry Hilgard proved that scientifically, which proves you can prove anything scientifically. You can prove that scientifically. I love it when I went to Hilgard's lab. I went to his lab, and he wasn't there, but he had some of his experts there. And they were explaining, and I was asking them questions. Like, I was looking at them, and I was, you know, because I was being real serious. You know how serious I can get. And I'd look at them, and I'd say, now, what you're telling me is that if you don't use a monotone, you can't go into a trance now, deeply. And they'd do this. No, you can't. And I'd go, so when a person shut your eyes tightly, when a person shut your eyes tightly, doesn't mean that they're going into a deep trance as much as you understand what I'm saying. Now, they go, yes. And so without using a thorough monotone, you can't get people to go deeper. No, you can't. I love picking on scientists. It's my hobby. They're so serious about things. They always do this. They go, no, of course not. That's right. And I go, so there's no way you could put people in a trance if your voice wasn't truly monotone. So if you change the pitch, it wouldn't make you go deeper and deeper. Still going deeper and deeper. There's no such thing as hypnosis, Robert. You understand that? Yeah. There's only consciousness and unconsciousness. Now? That's right. You can open your eyes shutly. You guys should have had the camera up here. You guys missed all the fun. But you have to have your eyes open to know things are going on. Now, I wanted to tell you that above and beyond the trick of going into the future, I wanted to give you a little pattern that I use. And what I'm going to do is have you just break for a few minutes. And this is a real quick exercise that I want you to add. I want you to have the same partner. And I want you to go back and I'm going to have you build in something. There's a trick that I've used for a long time with my clients to build in longevity of change. And I haven't told other people about it because I hadn't come up with a better way of doing it yet. Until I come up with a better way, you guys don't get it. It's the law of requisite variety. But since this is supposed to be closely held patterns, I thought I'd throw this one out for you. And that's mostly because I can't remember if I did it last time, and it won't hurt to get it again. But one of the things that I've used as a trick is I've used presupposition inside of my work so that failure, when people fail, when they make a change, a lot of times, now and then, they will revert to the old behavior. And I found that one of the things that happens is if people have one or two instances where they begin to revert at all, it means to them they have failed utterly. I've noticed this especially with dieting. When you listen to people talk about dieting or exercise programs, or if they're trying to give up alcohol or drugs or any of these things, that if you do a piece of work with them and they backslide even a little bit, it constitutes a thing where the whole game is over. That they set up an either-or situation. So one of the ways in which I've used timelines is to set up a failure presupposition by having people go into the future, 6 months, 12 months, and a year into the future, and having the experience of backsliding. And with some things, you know, I may make it a week or 2 weeks. For our purposes here, what I'd like you to do is to back up, take the four tuple, which where you guys were smart enough to anchor the one when you compressed it. Why are some of you gritting your teeth and looking at me? Whenever you get a good response out of people, you anchor it just in case. So if you always want to keep those around. And, you know, if nothing else, you anchor it just by naming it or use, you know, a contextual word. You know, or you kiss them in the left ear. There's any old anchor will do. If you didn't, don't worry about it because it's so recent they'll be able to go right back to it. But now what you want to do is to take them back to the present time, have them step into the new set of submodalities you've just created, the layered set. If any of you laminated them, as you have them step into the present, have them compress the lamination into a single feeling. Can you feel this? No. Yes, it's done now. Okay, once you've done that, then what I want you to do is to have your person go 1 week ahead, see, and in the future, doing NLP and reverting back to being boring, mundane, and too serious. Then have them go 2 weeks and revert back. The magic word here is revert back. And then when you have them go a month ahead and revert back to an example. Now this is where language becomes a powerful tool. Because if you can have them go into the future and revert back three times, it presupposes that when they reverted back, they went back to doing it the right way. That they went back to what's useful. If you give somebody a diet and you program them in the future to fall off the diet three times, the presupposition is they got back on it. Now, when you embed this in their unconscious on the timeline in the future, it alleviates this thing, which is a built-in mechanism in most people, that if they fail one small amount, that they're going, then the whole game is over. People talk about falling off their diet. They used to talk about falling off the wagon. That if people would stop drinking, if they started drinking once, then they were going to drink forever. You know, that whatever they did to stop drinking was over. By using a technique where you build in three failures into the future is actually more useful than building in three successes. Because it presupposes, since the failures are spread apart, that they're succeeding the rest of the time. So by using presupposition, you take care of this cataclysmic thing that if they backslide one little bit, and you also build in a very powerful presupposition that the rest of the time they're going to be succeeding. So the important part is that when you program it out into the future, you want more space between the failures so that if you start out with 1 week apart between failures, then it's 2 weeks, then it's 4 weeks, then 6 months. So that as you go future into the future, you spread apart the failures. Now, When I tried to teach this in the practitioner course, and I had an uprising in people because they told me if you did this, it would make it so people fail. And quite to the contrary, I have found it so that what happens is that people have trouble failing. Because since what they've done is to program themselves to backslide in a week, typically they're late. And what happens is they're so expecting it to come in a week, they have no trouble doing fine for the first 6 days. And when it comes time to backslide, they're not ready to backslide because they've been doing too well. And I get guilty calls from my clients. I do. I get guilty calls like, well, I wanted to know, you know, you did this thing where you said in a week I was going to backslide. Why didn't backslide? And I said, you didn't. You know, and I said, well, we'll see what happens in 2 weeks. I said, just start the same thing now. Now, by sliding time in that way, what happens is they built up a whole wealth of experience. But it also means if at any time in the future they backslide, now all they have to do is make it 2 weeks. So that you're building in a powerful set of presuppositions that make it easier for people to succeed by, and especially with your polarity responders. Your polarity responders never make it. The ones that have built-in polarity responses. Once they know they're supposed to fail, then of course they're stuck succeeding. And the thing is that it is also important when you use this, especially with your clients, not to explain it. Because they get uptight about it. They go, well, why would you want me to go ahead and plan to fail in a week? And I always look at them and I go, I don't. Just do what I say. This is one of the things about having firmness in your strategies, is because a lot of clients, if they can figure out what you're doing, then they can figure out how to sabotage it. If they don't understand what you're doing is programming them to be able... It's not a question of whether they go off their diet. It's a question of whether they get back on it. And as long as they can fail in a week, and then they have to fail again in 2 weeks, they have to get back on it in order to be able to fail again. And as long as they don't realize this is a way of getting them back on, not of getting them off. Because if they never fail, then they don't have to get back on. But even if you take a technique like we just used, so that when you start to do NLP with the client, you catch yourself, so you don't go into, you know, especially those of you who have done therapy for years, you don't want to go into a therapist mode and, you know, get serious and analytical and start thinking of, you know, if you catch yourself wanting to do reframing, that sort of thing, when you feel yourself wanting to say, go inside and ask, you can be cured of that. You don't have to do that anymore, you know. And, you know, there's some real weird byproducts of doing reframing. Especially with people who are, you know, somnambulistic hypnotic subjects, you know, you're kind of on the road to multiple personality. I mean, one of the things that blew me out is that when I was first introduced to the concept of multiple personality, other than seeing the movie The Three Faces of Eve, it turned out every multiple personality client I could find was discovered by a psychiatrist who used hypnosis and believed in multiple personality. And I couldn't find any exceptions to it. Now, it doesn't mean there aren't any, but it means if there are, there aren't very many of people who do this on their own. I mean, when that book Sybil came out, they broke out all over the place. You know, people watched that movie and their unconscious mind went, that's a better choice. But, I mean, before the movie came out, there was this psychiatrist in Santa Cruz who had discovered an epidemic of multiple personalities. And he published a list of symptoms. And there were ways that you could identify, and he had like 5 different personality traits. And the first personality trait on the top of the list was easily hypnotizable. And I went and saw this guy, and how he discovered is he noticed that sometimes people acted differently. So he gave the different behaviors different names. Then he hypnotized them and asked for the person behind that behavior to come out. And I want to tell you, this guy did some stuff that made Billy Graham looked like a straight man, you know. But of course, he had a medical degree, so it was okay to be weird. I mean, this guy was out there doing exorcisms on the helicopter pad at Dominican and calling my work nutso. I want you to think that one over. Yeah, he decided NLP was too strange. The stuff we did with people was dangerous. And yet he was walking up to people and walking up to somebody and going, Bert, come out, Bert, come out, Bert, come out. Hit him on the head, shit like that. He'd be whacking him, you know, until Bert would go, oh, Bert, anything you want. Quit whacking me in the head, you know. These are the people that think NLP is weird. I mean, these people that look, I love this shit. People look at you and they go, well, actually, you're talking to me and your parent now.
If you were talking to me as your child, then you would be sincere, but you're not sincere, so you're talking to me as your parent. Ooh-wee! And these people are telling me my stuff is outside. Well, I do have to admit that go inside and ask stuff is a little spooky. That's why I gave it up. Sometimes people go in there, you know, and I'd really want to run around behind them and go, nice day for an exorcism, isn't it? Now, what I want you to do is to remember, part of what you're learning is to put spice into your work so that when you use a technique like this, it's not just enough to go through it rotely. What you need to do is to literally, you know, have the person, you know, say, and now, you know, stop and first, you know, see yourself a week from now doing work with clients, looking enthusiastic and stuff. Then step inside your timeline, go out a week into the future, and then go back into the same old rut. So you catch them off guard, and they go, like that, right? And then go a week further and discover yourself doing this again. So it's a single unit of time. You want to use all the words and pieces of language that segregate time. Another time. Once again. All of the types of language that fragment out experience. For those of you who have not delved into Patterns 1 recently, go back. Patterns 1 is your guide to precise use of language. All of those appendices and the construction dependencies are designed to teach you how language operates in terms of the control mechanisms. It's not just a way of doing hypnosis, it's a way of using language methodically. In order to have it be a whole book instead of a handout, we had to write all that stuff about hypnosis in there. We needed the money at the time. But the construction appendices are still, in and of themselves, mostly really precise use of language. Then in my master track, one of the things that I make people do is to take a transcript of a tape where I work with a client and to go through and make 10 different columns where they go through and analyze language in terms of quantification. Because quantification of language is an important thing. The difference between each, always, every, and looking at how quantification affects which types of experiences are accessed and in what order. Because you look at quantification, and after that, then you look at sequences, or what we call chains, and in terms of what chains are being installed, which chains are being broken up. And as you begin to analyze things in terms of a multi-leveled outcome, it's not that that's what I was thinking about at that moment, necessarily, but it gives you the opportunity to learn how to be precise. I always tell people, if you'll find in each of my sessions, I always do everything wrong before I do it right. I will do one time at least, I will deliberately do something that mismatches what's going on. And even in the Marshall University tape with the lady that starts out, and she's, her first thing she says is, oh, well, I have a problem, I need to get more distance from. So the first time I did the switch pattern, I used size, right? Now, I do this as a test because you kind of get it partially. And then when you go back and do it the other, you can watch it zing. And I like to do that with clients. I do it a little bit tilted, and it makes them uneasy. It's a real mismatch. It's the same kind of a technique that, like, one of the things, if you watch in the film, sometimes I respond to clients with an absolute opposite answer to what they gave me. If they go, I can't do that, and I go, well, I'm really glad. That'll make it easy. Right? And you watch it go right by. Because they don't know what they said. They haven't got a good, most people can't remember the last thing they said. They're reacting. And the fact that they're reacting is, I respond as if they're reacting to something else. They get convinced if I'm congruent enough. Because my goal remains constant. As long as I hear what they say, I can decide what I respond to. Especially if a client is incongruent, you know, when they say to me, I could never stand up to my mother. And I go, boy, you're really going to enjoy it this time then. It'll put her in her place. So that you literally inverse the messages. For those of you who have most of you in here done mixed state communication? Some of you look real quirked when I said that. Is there anybody in here that doesn't know what that means? Mixed state communication. That's where you just ignore the conscious part and talk right through somebody. It's like trance, only you don't fuck with the trance part of it. You just talk to their unconscious, you know, and just assume that anything that cut you, and you literally focus your eyes about 3 or 4 inches behind their eyes and just keep talking to them. You go, he knows what I mean, doesn't he?
Sure.
Right. Guy's got a big mouth, doesn't he? Now, The thing is that when you use mixed state communication, what happens is you end up setting up a signal system. It's just like setting up finger signals, only you just do it in the waking state. And since most of people's behavior is unconscious anyway, it's not that difficult to do. And, I mean, you can do it deliberately. I mean, you can send messages to people as you put them in mixed state. But when you put them in a mixed state where they feel themselves responding in ways that they're not in control of, you're not changing their state so much as making them aware of what's going on anyway. And the fact that they feel unnerved by it just allows you to be able to begin to embed suggestions. Now, we used to do it that way because it was a quicker way of doing it than what it took to go with the reframing. It was the first step that made reframing unuseful because it just takes too long. Because some people, you have them go inside and ask, they could be there for a week. Have you ever noticed that? Some people, you go inside and ask this question and notice what happens. And they close their eyes, they go inside, and you go, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And you go, has anything happened? And they go, no. I mean, you know, their heart has to be beating. Something must be going on. It's just a question of what are they doing in there, doodling on their brain or something? That to me, that when you start dealing with compressing states, you're bypassing the need for that because instead of worrying about whether there is a part, because most of the time you have to understand you're creating them. They're not there. And I've decided people have too many parts as it is. Too many parts, too little behavior. And this is what builds internal conflict. So the more parts you create, the more potential conflict you have of creating in somebody. This is why I don't think that reframing in itself is all that ecological, even if you do go check at the end. Everybody may agree upon that, but you may have created potential conflicts in new situations by creating new parts. I mean, we used to sit around and just generate them wantonly, thousands of them. But given what happened to those people, I don't think it's a good idea. Too many people stuck at various levels of my development. I mean, they always end up writing a book about how to reframe everything at once. Instead of having to reframe it, instead what you can do is to begin to combine things. Now, then once you've combined states, then all you need to do is to connect them with the future. Because one of the big shifts that you make with people, I figure, when you do good NLP work, is to take the focus off the past and to put it on the future. That too many people believe that what happened in the past is what makes what's going to happen in the future. That they live in a cause-effects universe. You know, that since I was a wimp for 20 years, I'm going to be a wimp for 20 more. Now, if anybody taught me that this does not have to be the case, it was Ann Teachworth. Ann Teachworth told me that she had a relative that told her when she turned 50, she didn't have to speak her mind and she didn't have to worry about what people were going to think. And when Ann had her 50th birthday, boom, it happened. Because she believed it. She had a belief that when you turned a certain age, you change automatically. Overnight. And as long as she had one, that's exactly what happened. It just went poof, like this. Now, a lot of people have a belief that the way that they were determines how they're going to be. And people change overnight all the time. Any of you had a near-death experience? Right? Would you get up the next day and live the same way? Nope. That's right. Suddenly your value system changed. Some of those things that seemed so utterly important didn't seem so important anymore. Now, that's why I always try to provide my client with a near-death experience. Something to reassure you with. for some of them, it's probably as close as they'll get until they do a real one. But for me, the thing is that you always want to get people to be aimed at the future and sticking new things in the future. If I go through the past, I go through the past to blow up things. I mean, like last time we did the Decision Destroyer. The Decision Destroyer is a way of going through and just blowing apart the semantic response from the past. Now, the only way in which the past has a hold on your future is insofar as these cues that I talk about trigger familiar responses. But yet, sometimes those responses are not familiar. Now, what I want to do is just bracket for a few minutes. I want you to just go back with your partner, and I want you to program them to go back to the mundane way they worked, right? But now, do three failures, right? But start with a success. So what you do is you go back, you go into the present, have them see themselves doing NLP with this new change, excited, step inside of it, and fire off an anchor for the new state. have them enjoy it, then have them go a week into the future. And if you can totally build the expectation, right? Now, since I've already told you what you're going to do in here, go a week into the future and either have them succeed or fail. And then go another week so that you can keep them guessing a little bit. Now, as you go into the future, you want to build, primarily with clients, examples of single failures. You don't have to tell them they go back into success. You have them move further into the future and then fail once again. Then once you're done, then what you do is have them stop and then pick any period of time in the next, whatever, say you go 6 months into the future, 3 weeks, or however far is the maximum you went. When you're done, stop. Have them pick one point randomly in the future. Step inside it and tell you how they feel, or you should know by looking, because you should have a dramatic enough foretuple, and find out whether they move to success or failure. They move to success, you did it right. Use every presupposition you can stack in your language. Presuppositions are powerful. The presupposition, you don't want to presuppose that they're going to fail. You're building the presupposition that they're going to succeed. You move into the future, see yourself failing one time, going back, which means you have gone forward, right? It's a presupposition when you say, going back once to the old boring way you used to do it. By saying, once again, back, anything that is a repeat in future, if you build this into your language, at the unconscious level, you are giving a direct and overwhelming command that you will do it the positive way most of the time. It's not even a command, because you're only saying that you're going to see yourself falling back into that pattern. And notice how it feels to go back into that old behavior. Okay? Now, just do this real quick. Take about 5 minutes apiece, and then we'll move on and see what else we can do here. So, okay, you said you had a question.
When we were looking forward 1 week, 1 month, 6 months.
When we were looking forward.
Yes, when we were.
Okay, when Barbara was or you were?
Anne.
When Anne was or when?
When
each of you sequentially or both of you together?
First when she was looking
first
forward.
First when she was.
And then what? When I was looking
okay,
forward.
Sequentially, that's good.
Sequentially.
Very good. Okay. Just checking.
But when she was doing it, I was looking forward. At her with
why would we want to be in the land of sensory experience?
That's right. she said she stepped in to that one time going back to the old way.
Yeah.
Rather than just looking at it. Mm-hmm. So that was important for her
yeah.
to have that kinesthetic, and then she popped out rather than moving.
Well, what does that tell us about her? This in time, why would she do that?
And that yeah. worked great. I wanted to do it strictly out.
Doesn't surprise me a bit.
We did it both ways.
Good. Doing it both ways is going to be useful. See, just like in the other exercise, remember I had you do it all three ways? See, if you do it all three ways, you can't miss. Right? In other words, if you can't figure it out from somebody's language, the best way, because what you're doing is an upgraded version of future pacing. The concept of, when we started future pacing, one of the things that we were aware of was that a lot of times you could get behavioral change with people in a session. You know, somebody that had never stood up for themselves, you could goat them to the point where they'd stand up to you, right? But then when they'd leave your office, especially since most of my clients have had overdoses of therapy, they also have learned to disassociate those experiences. It's one of the thing that I got into with the encounter group people was that the concept was that you built this environment of trust with people where you could actually be more yourself and do more things than you could with your family. And that I always had a big problem with that, because it seemed to me this is where you wanted people to be able to do things, was in their life, not in your office. And especially not with a group of people, because, you know, you don't want people to have a more intimate relationship with a group of strangers than with the people in their life. If you're going to be intimate, you know, you're supposed to do it with your wife, not with your psychiatrist. And, you know, I, for a long time, used to get into it with shrinks, because shrinks would always say, well, you know, all these techniques are well and fine, but isn't the real core of therapy, the real thread and the most important thing, the relationship that the therapist builds with the client?
a more trusting relationship than they could know anywhere else. And I go, no, that's prostitution. That's a different thing. But for a long time, a lot of the training for psychoanalysts and psychologists, that they believe that building a more trusting relationship, the massive transfer, as they called it and all that stuff, is what it was about. For me, the trick is to gather information, not build a love life. You know, I mean, I want clients when they leave that the thought of staying fixed is a lot better than the thought of coming back. I like that. You know, and they think I could call Richard on the phone or I could just do it myself. Then I want them to go, I'll just do it myself. Jesus Christ. That, you know, I don't want to be their buddy. And that one of the things is when we discovered that this was a major problem for people, one of the reasons was that they could get angry. They could be honest with their shrink, but they couldn't get it to the outside world. So when I came up with the concept of future pacing, what I was trying to do was to take just the stimulus response conditioning and like take the, you know, the stimulus with the response and then do, there literally is a technique that was developed, you know, Pavlov, you know, hit the tuning fork, got the dog to salivate, and then hit the tuning fork and did something else. And then pretty soon he could just do this, the something else, and the dog would salivate. So that you could literally transfer stimulus from one thing to another. And as much as you would lose a little bit on a generalization gradient, you'd still get some out there. Well, what I wanted to be able to do was to make sure that whatever the kinesthetics, so that I took the cues that would occur in the world, that I took the way that their wife looked at them, that, you know, that, I mean, a certain tone of voice that people used, where their office, or, you know, the way their boss intimidated them with just raising one eyebrow, and to make that the cue to feel that way, so that it wasn't enough to get somebody to stand up for themselves. They had to be able to have that same feeling and look at the image in their head so that it would transfer over. Now what we're doing is we're trying to build more generative systems so that as the person goes into the future, that what we're doing is we're presupposing they're going to get where they want to go and making it so that it generalizes to a wider range of contexts, especially when we're dealing with things that, as far as I'm concerned, are more attitude adjustments. And the attitude adjustments, the primary ones I work for, are that people go towards the future in a positive way and away from the past. That, you know, that the amount of time that most of my clients spend thinking about the past as opposed to the future is simply not economical. That, I mean, even when they think about the future, it automatically TDs them to the past and gives them, you know, well, if I were to try to do that, then something like happened in the past would happen. And those are not necessary nor even logical connections. And I want to break that up so that I can build the feelings in them so when they think into the future, they get the feelings. In fact, the activity of thinking of the future generates positive feelings. And because to me, I want them to move towards the future and away from the past, especially what they don't like about the past. If it was bad, don't do it again. And the way to not do it again is to not do anything. It's to change the way you feel when it happens, not to change what you do. And it's not being in a group of people. I mean, like, after I did the platform skills and the trainer's training last year, I got hired by a company to go in and train people that do public speaking. They go around and they give lectures about a product. And they have people that had a lot of product knowledge, but as they put it, they were not snappy enough public speakers. That is not exactly what I would use as a description. They didn't even know they were in the business of selling, is the way I would put it. I asked people, because I watched each of them for 5 minutes do their shtick. And then I went through and I asked them some questions, because I was kind of curious, about how did they respond to the audience. And the first guy, because I had to ask this guy, because he had every cue that I've ever seen when I've done limited vision with hypnosis. That's where you get a client to like, if I was working with a client hypnotically, I would get him to disappear the rest of the people in the room. You do things like you put them in a deep trance and you go, is it all right to be alone with me? And they go, yeah. And I go, okay, in a moment you'll open your eyes and we'll be totally alone, which kind of presupposes the rest of the people aren't there. Now, when they do that, in order to create limited vision, there's a way in which people defocus their eyes to disappear things. And this guy pretty much was doing that. So I asked him, I said, what do you do with the audience? And he said, well, he said, basically, I pretend that they're not there. And he said, what I do when I walk up in front is I imagine a curtain and I pull it in front of the audience.
And I thought, gee, I ought to try that. Now, the thing is to me, like, if you're going to, like, talk to an audience, talk to them, right? And I mean, you know, to him, since he was afraid of talking to an audience, he disappeared them. But then it sounded like he was by himself when he talked. I mean, the thing is he was explaining things, but it sounded more like he was talking to himself. You know, like if he was in a room by himself, practicing going over a speech, right? And it was pretty rote, you know. And then he would even say, you know, and then I would say to you. I mean, it's not, he wouldn't just say it, he would say, and then I would say to you that this is a wonderful product. What I would tell you is that this is really going to be valuable. It's going to be one of the most useful things that you could use. And I could get you to understand that. And when I listened to his language, I mean, the presupposition was that he was alone. And in fact, he developed the technique of being alone. See, with somebody like him, what I want to be able to do is to open that curtain. But I want to start with the feeling of excitement. That, you know, it's, I want him, you know, to have the attitude, fresh meat to carve, you know. That to me, you know, that if somebody is, he had been in front of an audience and had froze up. So frozen one time he couldn't speak. And it was such a bad experience that every time he looked at an audience, he thought about that. Which is, I didn't think was the most effective way to be, put yourself at ease. I mean, so I pointed out to him, if he thought about it, made the picture big and bright and close, he could do it again. But if instead, every time he looked at that picture in the past, it cracked him up as ludicrous, and instead looked out and just looked at it, you know, the way you'd look at, you know, if you'd walked out on a smorgasbord that nobody had touched anything on, and you weren't supposed to eat any of it for 15 minutes, but you were alone. Right? Nice four-tuple, isn't it? Right? And anchor that, and then slowly open the drape and fire that anchor off so that his attitude changes. Because to me, one of the primary things that I'm trying to build in people is I'm trying to build in an attitude that's more pervasive than the single change. I even look at a lot of times that whatever the particular small thing is it's almost a hook for me. I mean, when I had the guy who was a social phobic came to me, it's not enough to change, you know, the fact. So he can sit down with a group of people and he's not afraid, but that doesn't, it's going to do any good if he's just boring and just sits there. It's like, okay, I'm not afraid. So then he can just be dull for the rest of his life as opposed to terrifying. You know, I mean, to me, you know, it's got to lead on to really looking at a single change as an opportunity to head off in a more powerful direction. That if you can begin, you know, if you can do an exercise, a little thing like you did this morning, where you step inside of exhilaration and it makes you feel different, and then you consider, look, if you can take that and make it so that all of your work becomes more exhilarating for you, then you're going to become more dynamic in the way you do it. Then you're going to learn to do more things. It sets up a direction and opens up a world. But then if you can begin to layer other stuff on there, and then do it no matter how hard you try to screw it up in vain, so that you begin to build something that, because, see, I find that too many times that people take powerful technology and they don't use it powerfully. And then, you know, because I get calls from people, they go, well, I went to two workshops and I learned to do the phobia thing and I read it in the book, but I do it with my clients and it only works sometimes. And I go, well, I'm surprised at that. Must be a fucking great technique if you can get it to work. Because it's not just the technique, it's an attitude and a methodology. It has to do with having some punch in what you do. And because it, as you teach people and take them through a series of responses, I mean, you know, you got to have a response to anchor it. I mean, we used to spend a lot of time developing people's sensory experience to see real minimal cues. And I stopped doing that because what happened is people didn't have to elicit intense responses, right? Since they could see minimal changes in lip size and breathing, they'd only access puny little responses. So I decided it's better I blind them, you know, and make it so the response has to be overwhelming, if that's what it takes to get them, to get people to respond. Because if you anchor five little chump change responses, and you can see the anchor go off, but it's so minimal they can't notice, it's not helpful. It needs to be just fucking dynamite responses, things that are volatile in nature. Anyway, does that answer your question?
Yes.
Good. Is there any other questions about what we've been doing or other stuff? That's it? That's all you want to know about NLP? The thing is if you want to learn advanced patterns, the thing is you got to have advanced interests. I mean, what kinds of things? I mean, you know, you've been using this stuff. What kinds of stuff do you not get enough dynamite with? Where do you find yourself not being powerful enough? What do you need to lace into your own experience? I'll tell you what, I can assign a homework assignment for you tonight. I want you, do you guys know what the word semantic packing means? Do you know what a semantically packed word is? A word like lurk is semantically packed. One does not lurk right through a crowd and speak their mind, right? It's a word that is so semantically packed, it induces. And see, when the kinds of experiences I've been asking you about, I've been picking words that are highly charged for experiences. Go home and make a list of them tonight. Make a list of highly charged, semantically primed names, nominalizations for experience that are powerful and positive and dynamic. Things that have chutzpah, right? And tomorrow I'll show you a closely held pattern of how to lace them into yourself. I'll show you the ultimate visual squash. I'll show you the way I do it to myself. It's a deep trance phenomenon, but it's fun. You can build your own external behavioral generator. Teach you sci-fi reality. But now, yeah?
One of the things that happens to me when I get into people's patterns or my own that are not comfortably, easily changed, and then they start changing, I get really tired.
Sorry, I'm not following you. First, I have to follow what you're saying.
Okay, well, I'm thinking of two different experiences. Let me talk about one first.
Good idea.
Yeah, the idea of working with someone whose patterns are very complicated and difficult for me to work with.
Well, what makes them complicated and difficult?
Because either they're so much like my own that I have to kind of figure out ways to get out of it. And what I'm saying is, you've mentioned before how when you really go through change, you get really tired or it like can give you a headache.
Some people do, yeah. You can if you do too much at one time. You can also get tired just because you think too much. I mean, I discovered that when people try to figure things out too much as opposed to being interested in what's there. And one of the major ways that happens is when people relate things to themselves. When you constantly relate behavior to your own, switch referential index with stuff and relate it to yourself rather than doing it on the outside, it will exhaust you. And from previous experience, I have a good idea that's what you do. See, one of the things that is a trap, it's the same empathy thing I talked about, is if you try to figure out other people by analyzing it inside of yourself, there's a difference between trying somebody's strategy to see if it produces the result. You do that as an interested party. That, you know, when I tried the thing with the lady that scared the shit out of herself when people were late, I didn't relate it to my personal life to see what kinds of things I do that are like it or that are similar. I took her literally at her word, did the steps literally, and see if it scared me. And if it didn't, then I went back and asked more. And if it did, then I was done. But I took her at her word and took her literally. I didn't examine to see if I did anything that was like it or anything that was similar. Because, see, when you search for similarity in yourself and a client, you will exhaust yourself. Because when you search for similarity, you will find it, whether it's there or not. And typically it will make it so that it seems more complicated than it is. Learning to do things in a disassociated state, that even if a client has similar patterns to you, you don't want to know about it. You know, that your job is to do it out there. And, you know, that, because you can always go back and figure that shit out later on. And I mean, you know, that's just hobby stuff. It gives you something to do between clients, you know, or to do at home when you're sitting in the dark or something. But I mean, to do it with a client, you really need to put it out there on the outside. That, you know, we talked about uptime. Well, uptime isn't even enough. You have to put yourself in such an uptime state that you're in the state of being fascinated and curious, and it simply never occurs to you that it relates to you at all. That you just keep it on the outside and find through it. The reason I teach people the rigor of always going back through and finding out if things work and going back through and seeing that they work so that you could punch the same button and get the same result is to keep it on the outside. You don't process the information inside you.
Sometimes you can stop and try it on, but you always know that you're trying on a sequence of theirs. And, you know, if it suddenly seems familiar and it's like you, then you're going to start mixing your shit up with theirs. And it just, it gets too complicated and too messy. And it's just not, it's not temporally useful. And it creates too much work. Makes it into work instead of fun. It's much more fun to torture them. Anything else? Inquisitive group we have here. You guys are going to have to go home and make some questions up tonight of what you'd like to know about. Yeah?
I got one now.
Good. I still make up more.
Okay.
What is it?
Last time you mentioned time distortion a couple of times without really going into detail on how to do that. I'm like, all right,
good portion. We didn't do time distortion last time?
Time before that you did.
No. Too late. There's some real fascinating things. The things about altering your sense of time. There's different tasks. And one of the major tasks that I deal with is removing semantic response. And semantic response has to do with, in essence, where you get your own shit mixed up with the situation that's going on. Because of the similarity of what's going on, you begin to respond as if there's other issues, as if hidden agendas are going on. That becomes, you know, when people are trying to get something done as a team, when, you know, they were trying to have a peace treaty about Vietnam, I mean, they were arguing over whether the table was round or square. I mean, these were not what we call team players. Because they were trying to establish positions, and they were their suspicions about other people's motives and all the stuff that was going on. And if you believe, like, all the time that people are trying to take advantage of you and you're looking for that, you'll be responding out of behaviors. And, you know, and if your father yelled at you and made you feel small, if somebody yells at you, you know, it can trigger off old feelings that aren't related. The Harvard Business Review figured that it cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $70 billion a year just to deal with semantic response, and that's not to cure it. That's just it going on in the boardrooms. That it's something which is human inefficiency. Did you have a question, or just stretching? Okay. Now the thing is like, in terms of time, I found that there's a little thing I actually that might be kind of fun to do, is if you stop and think about a situation in your life, something that happens repeatedly where you have trouble dealing with it. You know, maybe pick a person if you sort by the person. Pick a place if you sort by the place. Some people have trouble dealing with the banks. Some people have trouble dealing with a particular kind of person. Pick an example in your mind right now. Just go ahead and pick one. Okay. Go back and run through it in your mind. Okay. Now, the speed at which you run it in your mind, okay, is different than real time. Real time is clock time. Okay, when you run through a memory, you do it faster than the event that occurred, or you're the worst client anybody will ever have. I've had a few clients that run their memories at clock time, and those are people that are going into a deep trance right now. We will have no personal conversation. There's nothing. Go back and remember a time you did this, and you know, hour and 45 minutes later, you know, they come out and go, "Yep. Got it." Now, okay, then if you take internal time and the speed at which you ran the memory, no matter how it subjectively seems, it may seem like it was the same because you can do time distortion mentally. Now, inside of the memory you just had, the speed at which you were moving in your own perceptions. Now, some of you might have seen yourself in the memory. Some of you saw what you saw at the time because those are your choices. Okay. Now, the internal speed, there's two components. Typically what happens is that you, person X, and the event Y, are moving at the same speed. Now, if you stop, now what I want you to do is to go inside, and I want you to step inside of yourself at the beginning of the memory. And I want you to just to hold it as a solid frame, okay? So it's just fixed. And what I want you to do is I want you to hear like a rheostat in your head. What I want you to do is to turn yourself down to half speed and then start the memory. So the memory moves at normal speed, and you move at half speed. Okay, now go back to the beginning, right? Freeze it as a frame. And again, give yourself a little dial that you can hear clicking. I want you to click yourself back up to normal. Now what I want you to do is to click yourself so you're moving twice as fast. That means everything else will appear to be in slow motion. But I want you to run the memory at the same clock time. But you'll move twice as fast, so it'll take twice as long in your subjective experience. Try that. It's the opposite of what you just did. Got all that, Keith? Do the experience, then take the notes, okay? It's easier that way, because if you're going to miss anything, it's just the note, not the experience. All right, now what I want you to do is I want you to go back and do exactly the same thing you did the first time around that I asked you to. Run the memory, quote unquote, normally now and see how it feels different. So what happens? You can't do it. You must do it. Well, you didn't want to. Well, now, that's chicken shit. I told you to do it. This is experiment. Think of yourself as an adventure. Just go back and run it clock time so that you're now. You know you can always change it to the way you liked it. Go back and run it the same time. When you say you can't do it, it means you don't want to. You found a better way. Well, you want to find the way to have control over your brain. It's not going to feel the same anyway. Just go ahead and run it. What did the rest of you find when you went back and ran it then?
It seemed really slow.
Slow. You didn't have the same
more disassociated situation.
You didn't have the same response?
No,
because
it
seemed really slow.
Yeah, it's like, oh, come on, let's run this over with.
Didn't have time to have all those bad feelings, did you? You're going, hurry up! Now, the ability to control your own sense of time, both inside of your control of your internal memories, is that what happens is that you're dealing with semantic response, because your semantic response is fixed with time. Because given that you have certain semantic responses, one of the things is they take a certain amount of time. Now, try something even trippier. What I want you to do now is literally take, for example, take something that you enjoy, but you really want to enjoy it more. Right? Not yet. I'll tell you when. God, Jesus Christ, you guys. Just take it and go away. Don't bother me and pester me no more. See, now as soon as I say good feeling, see, I can always tell when people have done an SNLP. You say good feeling and they jump in, right? You know, you can always tell. This is an advanced group. An introductory group, you go pick a feeling and they go, oh, shit, you know. You guys start turning out to be ecstasy junkies. Now, the thing is I want you to take a good feeling. Now, this time what I want you to do is just before you go in, I want you to figure out what would make it feel better. Because some things feel better if they last longer. And some things feel better by going faster. You got to remember, if you speed yourself up, the event slows down. And if you slow yourself down, then the event speeds up. Or the opposite. Depending upon who you are and what you're doing. Now, so I want you to stop and figure out, do you want the event to last longer or be quicker? Then what I want you to do is then take the sound of the rheostat that you have. Okay, and this is why I built the sound in. What I want you to do is to start into the experience that you enjoy and turn the rheostat. First, I want you to slow it yourself down, keep the event going the same, and see if it increases your enjoyment. If not, turn it the other way. And keep turning it until you can heighten the enjoyment more and more and more. Until you can fine-tune it by hearing the clicks on your rheostat back and forth. Till you literally tune yourself in to the speed that fits with that experience to maximize your enjoyment. Go ahead. Now you can go try it.
into a mellow group here. All right. So now what do you want us to do?
Now, the sense of time that you just built, okay, you now have an anchor internally for something that controls that. True? Okay. Now, what I'd like you to do is to think of something that clients do that throw you off kilter. For example, when they yell, does it throw you out of whack? When they cry? Is there certain things that people talk about that throw you out of whack? Because, see, you're a human being. You're not a fucking piece of furniture. There are some subjects that are hard to talk about. There are things that get you hooked, you know. I mean, you know, there are certain words that you can say, you know, that set you into not maximizing things. There are probably, if you run through in your mind the clients you have, there will probably be a couple that when you cross them in your mind, you get this little voice that goes, bleh, you know, or ones that go, oh, shit, you know. There are some kind of clients that probably are the ones you don't want to work with. And those are the ones that would probably be the best because they'd be the most challenging. But you haven't gotten into the state where you look at the more difficult it is, the more fun it is. There's more to figure out, and there's more to try, and more new stuff to learn. That, you know, that one of the things that, for example, for a long time I didn't like to see depressives because they were so boring. And they talk too slow. You know, they come in and they go, well, last week. I go, what? You know? And I mean, they'd make me nuts. Well, I found out that one of the things that I could do is if I speeded myself up three times as fast, I hit a threshold where it didn't matter anymore. That instead of it bothering me that they went slow, I began to bother them instead. And that's where something began to happen. Now, if you take now and go back to the event that I had you pick, something where the situation where you didn't like it. Remember the first one? Okay. Now, you remember which direction you went in that made it better? All right. Now, what I want you to do is to go back and pick another event that's like it, something else where you don't like the way it works. Since we screwed that one up, I want you to just pick a new one. Only this time, I want you to go in, and I want you to click the way that didn't work, but I want you to jam it through the ceiling. So run through it, and instead of just cutting it in half, if cutting it in half wasn't the one, like doubling it was the one you like, this time, cut it in half again, and cut it in half even again. Just jam it through the ceiling with your rheostat in the opposite direction as the way the one worked. Because you'll discover going both ways will disengage semantic response. One way, it hits the point of being totally ludicrous. And when it starts getting ludicrous, it starts giving you choices about what to do in those contexts. Like, for example, pick the client that aggravates you. Go back to the last session and turn that dial wildly in the opposite direction. Try it. Find out what happens. And see if ideas don't begin to pop into your mind of other things that you might say, which might interject some humor into the situation. Be extreme about turning that knob. When you look at it, it'll give you a different way of reading their nonverbal behavior. In one context, it's like making a videotape go 10 times as fast. In the other, it's like having one go 10 times as slow. In either case, it's going to exaggerate everything that your client does to the nth degree, including whatever it was that was bothering you, to the point where it won't, because the things that affect you in real time. Gregory, what happened when you did that?
It was sort of like a ludicrous generator. It was a lot more humorous, slowing it way down. Except I'm sitting here thinking that, okay, I can do it, sitting here thinking about it. But when it's
well, we haven't done the rest of it yet.
Okay.
Don't jump ahead. Now you have to learn to do it on the outside.
Yeah.
Okay, which, even for the sake, we might repeat that a little bit. But I tell you what we'll do. Since it's a little warm in here, why don't we take a 10-minute break? Okay, do you have any questions about this so far? Thus far?
Okay. If not, what I'd like to do is I'd like to take this and I'd like to stack it apart. I'm going to have to back up to the exercise that we did, not last time, but the time before. And because I want to set up your ability to adjust your subjective experience of time. Okay, and I know some of you did that and some of you haven't done it. But I want to run through it real quick. And since we got a half an hour, what we'll do is we'll run through it right now. And if you're not done, you can finish it up afterwards before we get back tomorrow. And then we can take it and build with it. Basically, what it boils down to is I want you to find extreme. These are the kind of words you're going to be looking for in your homework. Words like extreme. Because you're looking for an extreme example of fast time. Okay. Do you know what fast time is? That's where, you know, you go somewhere, you're having a good time, and whack, the day goes by like that. Ever had an experience like that? You went somewhere and, you know, it was 9 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock at night. You know, either that or you went out, it was 9 o'clock at night, and you looked at your watch, and damn, it was 6 o'clock in the morning. Oops. You know, and then you went home and you told somebody, well, I just got lost, I was having so much fun, and they went, that's a likely story. But that's what happened, is time just went, flew by. That's fast time. Slow time is where you're waiting in line. Right? You're waiting in line, you walk up somewhere, you know, the movie is going to start in 5 minutes. You wait what seems like a half an hour. You look at your watch, and 1 minute has gone by. And you feel like you've been listening to the two people in front of you talk for a week because they're talking about the importance of Marshall McLuhan as a poet. Right? And they're going on and on and on about it. The last 10 minutes of an airplane flight, there's a good example, takes 2.5 hours. Right? The pilot comes on and says, we'll be on the ground in 10 minutes. And you fly for an hour and you look at your watch, and 1 minute has gone by. Right? The pilot comes on and says, now we'll be on the ground in 15 minutes. Because only airlines can make time go backwards. If you've ever waited in line to buy a ticket at the airline, and you are third in line, and they have three people at the ticket counter, and the person, I love this, because they look over at you and they go, what is your name? And you tell them, and they go, and then they look up and they go, and where were you going? They go, it doesn't tell you yet? They go, Chicago. Oh, what was the flight number? I don't know, I don't work here. Uh-oh. I don't know who programmed that thing, but that person should be killed. Slowly. They should put them up on a hang noose and leave them there for a week. And then have somebody walk up like this and go, and take 2 weeks to pull the handle. Because those kind of experiences are slow time. Now, what I want you to do is to take somebody and... The important part of this is to get them inside the experience. You cannot do this disassociated. You want to get them right there. Take them back in their timeline and drop them in so that they're there. This is where you pull out your hypnosis voice and have them go back fully and completely, words like completely, utterly, and honestly back to that experience so that you fully have them go back and go through the experience until they get that sensation. And as they get the sensation, have them allow their hand to rise up, and then have them go and do fast time. First do slow time, then fast time. Then I want you to compare the difference in the submodalities so that you find out the difference between fast and slow time. Okay? So once you have fast, we'll make that short because it's quick, and slow time. Once you have the submodalities, what I want you to do is, as you go through, to build a sliding anchor. Do you know what sliding anchors are? Yes? Well, you missed a lot, Marlene. Where you been? Sliding anchors work this way. When you go through, as you go through, when you find a difference in the submodalities, slow time, fast time, because all we're looking for are the things that are different. When you find a difference, what you do is, so we find out that things seem larger than life or smaller than life. Okay, that's one of the distinctions. That not that the images are small or the images are big, because remember, you're going to be inside this, just like when you were there. But I've noticed when time is moving slow, everything seems smaller than life. That's one of the distinctions in my world. So what I do is, not only do you anchor it, like you anchor it on the knee here, but you have the person shrink it down even more
And as you do, you slide your finger a little bit. And then you do that with each of the submodalities where you find a dramatic difference, and you end up with an incredibly powerful anchor. You make a sliding anchor, one on each knee, slow time, fast time. Okay. While you're doing this, you are doing a trance induction the whole time. Remember, hypnosis voice, so that you get them inside the states, oscillate them back and forth. And then what you do is leave them in fast time. In other words, go back, access both, and then leave them in fast time so that time is just moving a mile a minute, you know, where time goes by. You have a nice anchor for it that's exaggerated. Have them open their eyes, stay in fast time, fire off the anchor, and open their eyes and look around. And if they're there, people will be moving somewhat slower, talking somewhat slower, and they'll be having fun. See, I always thought it was a ripoff that when you're having a really good time, whoosh, it goes by, and when you're waiting in line, it takes too long. That doesn't seem fair. So I wanted to learn to switch these, and that's exactly what I did. That way, the last 10 minutes of going down in a plane goes whoosh, like this, and having a good time takes forever. Of course, you can't think of a good use for that, unless you have an imagination like mine. Okay, what I want you to do is go ahead and get started, and you won't get it all done, but maybe you can find somebody you can work with a little bit tonight or tomorrow morning before I get here, okay? Get yourself a partner, get going.